Welcome to Intesa San Paolo On Air, the English language insight series produced in conjunction with the University of Oxford, where we embark on global conversations with global leaders. My name is Rupert Younger, and in this, our latest episode, I'm in conversation with Irene Tinagli, the Italian politician and economist who has served as a member of the European Parliament since 2019. In this episode, I'm speaking with her about social housing, drawing on the work that she's recently completed as chair of the Special Committee on the Housing Crisis in the European Union. Irene graduated with a BA in management from Bocconi University in Milan before pursuing both a Master of Science and a PhD in public policy from Carnegie Mellon University in the States. In 2010, she was named by the World Economic Forum as a young global leader, reflecting the work that she was doing as a young academic at the Carlos III University in Madrid, and also for her work in the associated advisory positions within EU governments, the UN, and the European Commission on topics related to innovation, creativity, talent management, urban and regional development. In 2013, she was elected to the Italian Parliament in Mario Monti's Civic Choice Party before joining the Democratic Party in Italy, from where she went on in 2019 to be elected as a member of the European Parliament. Now, this report and this conversation could not be more timely. The EU's Parliament's report into social housing in Europe lands at a moment when Europe's housing crisis has finally been recognised as a systemic threat rather than a marginal social issue. Across the continent, rents and house prices have outpaced wages. Social housing stock has shrunk in several countries, and waiting lists for affordable homes have lengthened, leaving low and middle income households, students and young families shut out of stable and affordable housing. The report treats housing as a core social priority for the EU, linking affordable homes to better health, stronger social cohesion and improved access to economic opportunity. Now, the report matters because it does three things at once. It quantifies the scale of the shortfall in affordable and social housing. It calls for a long-term European affordable housing plan backed by serious public and private investment. And it frames housing policy as critical economic infrastructure rather than just some form of discretionary welfare add-on. In other words, this is not just another Brussels paper. It's a political signal that no more excuses will be accepted on housing and a potential turning point in how Europe finances, regulates and protects the homes on which everyday life depends. So, Irene, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast. Let's start with a little bit of background. What brought you into politics from the world of academia?
Oh, okay. So that was a tough choice. As you can imagine, it's not easy to change one's life course. But since I had been studying so many years and, you know, public policy, and I was also involved in some think tanks or writing on, I had my column on a newspaper commenting and criticizing often, you know, economic policy of the government and so on. So when I had the chance to, you know, measure myself, I thought this is the opportunity to try to do something, because it's easy to criticize others. And then I wanted to test myself. And so I took up the challenge. And I have to say, it's been quite a challenge, but also very, very interesting.
It's a very important move, isn't it, to move from deep analytical thinking into a different frame, which is how do I actually impact many, many people at scale on critical issues? And that's a very powerful draw, I can imagine, because you've done your deep thinking and you're still, of course, doing that. But the chance to turn that into real impact affecting very, very many people must have been highly attractive to you.
Yeah, but it's been very difficult at the beginning. So I was very attracted by this possibility of putting things into practice, what I had been studying or thinking. At the same time, I have to be honest, at the beginning was very, very difficult. When you are an academic, most of the things may happen inside the room with you reading and studying or, you know, cracking your numbers. and this, it's not the way it works in politics and policies. Almost never. So you have to meet people to create momentum, to share ideas, to compromise and find solutions. So this is a completely different approach, and there is no academic training for that. Unfortunately, you have to try.
Now, you seem to like trying new things because you, of course, initially stood as a member of the Italian political system. And then you decided to stand as an MEP, having built a career, first of all, in Italian politics. So was there a particular, I guess, moment or issue that convinced you that Brussels and Strasbourg were where you could have the most impact?
Well, first of all, you know, being an economist, nowadays in the European Union, most of the economic regulations and directives, they come from Brussels. So really, at the national level, there is very little leverage. And especially if you are in the parliament, that it's very limited. So I thought that the European Parliament could be the place where I could have a bigger impact, and also the place where I could better leverage my background. National politics, not just in Italy, but almost in every country that I've known, it's more dominated by political kind of conflict. It's very polarized. Of course, there is also the media, the public, the daily debate that in the end pushes aside the deeper analysis on the policies. But for me, policy is more important than politics in the strictest sense. And in Brussels, I found a way of being more focused on policies and what works and what doesn't work rather than the daily conflict on small political things.
Very interesting. And certainly that difference between policies and politics resonates strongly. So let's move on to policies. Now, you've described housing as a systemic crisis for Europe. What in your view makes this moment different from previous housing crises?
Yeah, the what makes it different is that, first of all, is that it's starting to involve not just the biggest cities in Europe. You know, traditionally we were used to know that places like Paris or London or Madrid were less affordable. But now we see this affordability issue everywhere. We see that in middle-sized cities, university cities, touristic cities, even small towns, as long as they are in some attractive place, maybe touristic, maybe coastal, even on islands, for example, which makes it very difficult for residents and workers to afford the place where they have to live or work. And the second thing is that this fear, spreading out of the crisis is starting to affect the middle class as well. So it's not just about, we were thinking in the past that housing affordability was a problem for the most fragile, those who cannot work or outside of, you know, that have some sort of fragility. But now it concerns the middle class. Workers cannot keep up with the price trends in housing, both for purchase and renting. And so this makes it quite different.
And that, yes, and that spread across the socioeconomic groups makes it systemic rather than particularly vulnerable communities only. Okay, that's, yeah, very interesting. And during the preparatory works for the report, were there particular stories from tenants or young people, homeless organisations, or indeed the vulnerable middle class that you've just been talking about, that you drew on and which shaped your thinking?
Oh, yes, there were many. Also because, you know, I was reached by, you know, regular citizens telling me their stories. And sometimes they were really moving. I remember this single mother And her rental contract was expiring because and the owner had recently died, and the daughter of the owner who inherited the apartment said, "I'm willing to renew the contract, but I need to change the rent because I have to adequate to the new market conditions." And she asked for an increase of 250 euros per month. So she's a single mother, one salary. The average salary in Italy, it's really like 1,300 per month. And she said, "I started to look around because I can't leave. I can't, go on with an increase, such an increase in rental, but I cannot find anything. I can't find anything cheaper than that. And I don't know what to do. And I'm not even eligible for certain programs of social housing programs because I am working. So I'm not the traditional fragile category. And I have no clue how to plan my future or my son's future." So that was really moving. And I also remember when I was in Lisbon, this is another thing that touched me. I was talking to a university professor. In Lisbon, the situation is very critical for prices and rentals. And he told me, in my first year of courses, I lose 20% of my students because they can't afford to live in Lisbon. So it's not that they drop out, I don't know, but probably they just move to a more peripheral university. Some will drop out, some others will end up in other places that are cheaper. I don't know. But the fact that you have students that are dropping out of the university and course they choose to pursue for their future, for their opportunities, they give up because they cannot afford to live there. It is something, I've been a student, I've traveled a lot, I've pursued opportunities around Europe. And I cannot think that we are growing up generations that have to give up these opportunities.
These are very powerful stories. And I can see that they shape the way that you approach the design of the report and also then how you think about some of the recommendations. During those preparations for the report, I was also keen to understand if there was one particular macro or global problem or statistic, or European problem or statistic, which convinced you that this couldn't be just incrementally important, but genuinely transformationally not business as usual anymore. Was there one particular aha moment that convinced you that this was really a moment to take it much more seriously than we had been in the past?
Well, when I started to see the statistics, as I said earlier, that we are not only about Milan or Paris, so that we started to see numbers from regions and cities which I would have never imagined would have experienced such problems. And also when I started to see other phenomena that sometimes, now that we do, but in the past we didn't think, for example, that phenomena like touristic flows could affect a housing market and prices. But when you see numbers like going back to Lisbon, there are certain neighborhoods in Lisbon where 60 or 70% of the apartments in the downtown are occupied by touristic rentals. So they are not available for long-term rentals for families and couples, etc. That makes you think that we are facing a structural change in the market that requires an extraordinary policy and targeted policy making.
And of course, it blew into public consciousness for the rest of us when you saw what happened in Barcelona, of course, with the riots on the streets and local people feeling left out by the extraordinarily large amount of tourists who were visiting the city. That was also presumably a moment.
Absolutely. We also visited Barcelona because Barcelona is probably one of the first cities to experience this kind of increase, which is related also to some positive things when you are a city that is very attractive, it's very beautiful, it's very dynamic. So you attract tourists, you also attract investments, you attract business events. But this causes a displacement of the people who live there and eventually creates both social and economic problems, because even municipal companies cannot find workers, essential workers, to keep the services for the city up. So we have these cities where it becomes impossible to live in for nurses, for bus drivers, for policemen. So it's becoming a huge, huge problem also for, the functioning of the city itself. So absolutely. And you see citizens that are desperate because they are afraid and they about their own future and their children's future, because they are not sure anymore that they can count on a roof over their head.
I think I'm getting a big sense of how systemic this particular problem is, for sure. Very interesting. Tell me, it's a very complicated, I appreciate, an extremely complicated picture, but your job has been to try and cut through that and to try and find some concrete issues, themes and recommendations which can start to see or provide a pathway for some solutions. So which recommendations, I guess put in plain language, would you want an ordinary tenant or a young family or the bus driver or the policeman in Barcelona to understand?
Oh my God, most of our recommendations are targeted to governments, not to tenants. But so your question is even more interesting. And this is the message that I would like to give the tenants and the citizens. I would like to tell them, it's not your fault. It's not your failure. And you have to voice your problem, because your problem should be the problem of your governors and administrators. And, because this is something that have contributed to the problem. For decades, many policymakers, politicians, and even citizens, they thought that this is how it is and how it should be. You know, the market provides for houses. If I cannot afford a house, it's because either I don't work enough, I don't earn enough, there's something that it's wrong with me. And this is not the case. So this is not a regular market. Used to be a place where we used to have welfare policies, which we stopped supporting decades ago. And what we see today is also the result of a political and economic failure. So, but I think it's important, because many people still think, and they're kind of afraid, they feel ashamed that they cannot afford a house for their family. They think it's their fault. We need to tell them it's not like that, and you should voice your problems. I don't see that enough. I'm in Brussels. We are used to have protests of all kinds, all sort of powerful lobbies. They come here and protest, and we don't have the regular citizens protesting for the house. We need their voices. So voice that out and don't feel it's your fault.
That is such a powerful call to arms. And of course, it does speak to the unspoken problem, which is that we all of us think that it's our problem when something like that fails. But just simply pointing out that macro structural problem is an incredibly valuable starting point. Now, the report also calls for this European Affordable Housing Plan. So what does that actually mean in practice, if we put this into the practical side of things? And how would it change what national governments, what you're calling on national governments to do?
Okay. The national governments are still the ones that have all the competences in terms of housing policies. So what I hope is that the work that we do in Brussels will also show them that they need to commit more to housing policies, to resume real housing policies and to commit resources. So we are trying now in Brussels to fight a battle to have more funding and resources. But if we don't have a clear and strong commitment on the side of the national governments, it will not work. So we need that first. And we also need them to really find new ways to provide for housing policies. We need new models because the needs also have changed. So for example, I'll just give you a quick example. In the past, many housing policies in many member states, but also in the United States, for example, were pushing for ownership, trying to support buying houses. But right now we have a huge problem to support labor mobility, students' mobility, or the first stages of your careers, which not necessarily is in the same place. So life in today's society is far less residential than it used to be. So we need to find models that accommodate for this mobility and this increasing uncertainty on what where you will be in 10 years. So this implies that we can have more innovative models, that we can look more at rentals, and but they need to explore that, and they need to involve partners that are interested in providing long-term solutions. So if they are only looking for investment funds to provide some money, but the investment funds, of course, they will seek to maximize their returns, and this will not help solving the affordability problem.
This is very interesting. Of course, you talk about models, and having visited all the different European capitals and countries and cities, what did you find when you looked at that different patchwork of different approaches? Because trying to find a singular approach must be incredibly difficult. I'm kind of interested about the examples. We've spoken in the past about what you've seen in Vienna versus Barcelona versus Rome, and there's some very different models and approaches across Europe. Which examples do you think others should learn from, and what makes them work?
Okay, yes. It's been an amazing journey also because of this. You know, traveling around Europe, I've had the chance to really see firsthand how many different models, solutions. It is indeed a quite a interesting patchwork. But there are some models that I think can be looked at and replicated in other places, or at least to take inspiration from. Vienna is often used as a reference, one of the best practices, because it's a model that over the decades has always invested in social housing and increased the stock of available housing at affordable prices, which now it is so large that can really respond to the needs both of the most fragile, but also the middle class, teachers, professionals. You know, the vast majority of the middle class in Vienna lives in social housing projects, and this is made possible by long-term view, patient, and certainty of the funding that comes every year and reinvest in the maintenance and in new project. So it's a strong commitment also on the side of the federal government and the municipal government, so many resources as well. And a commitment and a model that involves both the public sector and the private sector, where the private sector is anchored to the need to have a social impact. So it's mostly cooperatives, not for profit. So it's a very nice model that puts together different stakeholders with the same objective and with a long time horizon, a structural and certain resources. And this has proven to work very well. Other countries, like Northern European countries like the Netherlands and Denmark, they also have been able to provide good solutions by involving the cooperative model or public banks and local banks together with other cooperative models, because this is a private sector that doesn't have to maximize the profits. And so, of course, it seeks economic sustainability, but also seeks to have a social impact. So these are the models that work better. However, other models that we see where you don't have this tradition, where you don't have all these, either the resources available or the models of cooperatives and so forth, we see an increasing use of regulation as a way to intervene in the market in the faster way. In some places, now they are mixing regulation with, even in Austria or Northern European countries, they are also using a little bit of, for example, regulation of short-term rentals to avoid contaminating the market, the real estate market. So they regulate a little bit short-term rentals, touristic rentals, while at the same time investing in social housing. Where you don't have the ability to invest a lot in social housing, sometimes regulation becomes stricter in the attempt to change the dynamics of the market faster, like, for example, introducing a rental price cap, like it happened in Barcelona and Catalonia. In France also, they tried to do that. In Berlin, they tried that many, many years ago. Then they changed it because it was too strong a regulation, affected the supply negatively. So it's a mix of measures that we see in Europe.
Very interesting, and a rich and diverse series of approaches, right? And with some very different contextual histories. Now, there are some criticisms which have been levelled. One of, I think, the most interesting is this idea that social housing risks concentrating poverty rather than fostering mixed, inclusive communities. How do you respond to that?
It depends on how you design it. The problem is that if you design it only as I need to build apartments and I need to find a piece of land and some funds and investment to build up 100 to 100, 1,000 to 1,000 apartments, that is probably for the social and the fragile categories, that's going to be a failure. So you need to have projects that involve the development of communities. So you build, you don't build just a house, you build a community. So you need to involve regional and local governments because they know the territory, the social fabric. And also today, we mentioned earlier, we need to be creative and be more innovative. We can have like mixed projects. We've seen, we do have examples of that, where you build new projects where a part is dedicated to social housing for the most fragile, a part is dedicated more to the middle class, a part could be dedicated to commercial real estate, so you can bring also services, restaurants, bar, cafes. You can bring part of office space. So in Milan, they brought the municipality, renovated a whole area of social housing and decided to bring there a part of the municipal offices and services. So you would have employees going there every day. And also there is a part of a building that has been rented to the university. So you have students going there every day. And so you bring this diversity of people who go there to work and to leave the city in an integrated way.
Where does the money come from? What's the mix of EU funds, national budgets, private capital? What's realistic?
Okay, for social housing, we already have lots of European funds that have been deployed, especially in the past few years. We have about 43 billion euros that have been taken from different European programs, which is Recovery and Resilience Facility, which we created after the COVID, which is European Social Fund, which is also InvestEU, which provided guarantees to de-risk investment projects that have been also dedicated to social housing. So there have been tools. The problem is that we need to make it, in my opinion, more homogeneous, less fragmented, and also more structural, you know, long-term, because the Recovery and Resilience Facility, which provided for the biggest chunk of these funds, is going to end this summer. So that's why I believe, and our, you know, the Committee on Housing calls for more, you know, long-term structural funds dedicated to housing in the next multi-annual financial framework, which is a bad word that means the budget. So, but of course, this will not be enough. Member states, as I said, will have also to find their own resources. They have to commit their own resources to housing policies to match European funds. They can do it by attracting patient capital, like some forms of institutional investors can be interested in some projects that have, you know, a long-term horizon. Maybe the public sector can put like a guarantee, and in order to make the investment less risky, and so that these investors could be willing to bear to have lower returns, but also lower risk on a longer horizon. But there's another thing. I've seen that many member states are also trying to have dedicated funds, public funds, that comes, for example, for a small, tiny percentage of companies' profits that goes to a fund to support social housing for workers or, you know, for communities. So member states are trying to find different sources of funding. If there is a will, a political will, there is a way.
Finally, what single feeling or takeaway do you most want our listeners to have? Urgency, hope, anger, or something else?
Right now, I would say urgency, because we live in a time of multiple crises. Every few months, we have a new crisis, a new priority. And my fear is that all these new priorities may end up forgetting about the housing crisis, which is not, you know, the word crisis was meant to think in terms of urgency, but it's not a temporary crisis. This is a structural change. So we need really to change also the way that we design our policies, that we think that our financing for and funds for the future. But if you keep delaying because you think that there is a biggest priority today, a biggest priority tomorrow, you will never address this problem. But this problem will remain, and it's a very long term. So we need to start now.
Thank you, Irene. As Europe wrestles with a housing crisis that's shaping everything from family life to political stability, Irene Tinelli's message is disarmingly simple. Housing is not a luxury. It is infrastructure for a fair and productive society. In this conversation, we've heard how social and affordable homes sit at the crossroads of climate policy, labour markets, public health, and intergenerational justice, and why her February 2026 report, the report that her committee then publicly released in February, is meant both as a blueprint and a wake-up call. If there's a thread running through it all, it's that there's no more excuses applies not just to governments and markets, but to all of us who accept that precarious housing is normal. The question she leaves us with is this: if we treated a decent home as essential as a school or a hospital, how differently would we design our cities, our budgets, and our politics? So that just leaves me to say a huge thank you, Irene, to you for spending time with us. Thank you very much for spending time from Brussels. It's deeply appreciated. And thank you for the incredibly valuable and important report. And for all of those of you listening, until next time, thank you so much. Yeah.